Okay, so as I was finishing off this paper and preparing to come here, I overheard my daughter singing a song that caught my attention, and I just want to play it for you.
Hello, my name is Alexandra Dawson. I am in grade 2. My music teacher taught me this song to learn a canon. A pizza hut, a Kentucky Fried Chicken and a pizza hut. McDonald's, a Kentucky Fried Chicken and a pizza hut. And we do it as a canon.
So I wanted to share that with you essentially as a prelude to my paper, because it's a good example of the ways in which commercialism intrudes upon the curriculum in very unexpected ways. In September 2003, Cindy Sedon, the new principal of Pitt River Middle School in Port Coquitlam, part of the Coquitlam School District in British Columbia, introduced healthy food into her school cafeteria. Gone were the McDonald's, burgers and fries, KFC and Pizza Hut. Instead, the new menu consisted of fresh sandwiches, bagels, macaroni and cheese, fruit and milk. Despite support from staff and parents, and to the shock of the Parent Advisory Council, district officials soon overruled and reversed these efforts. The school district had piloted the idea of school food courts in 1999 and expanded the program thereafter. In doing so, district administrators claimed jurisdiction over school cafeteria policies. Schools have long sold soft drinks and chocolate bars in hallway vending machines and fast food such as hamburgers and French fries in their cafeterias. In the 1990s, however, as companies searched for new markets and school boards faced continuing financial cuts, soft drink and fast food companies, what I'll refer to as big food, gained significant entry into the schools. This trend occurred as medical officials proclaimed childhood obesity to be an epidemic and warned of a likely decline in lifespan for current and future generations. The turn to big food is part of a larger pattern of commercialization in North American schools that has been intensifying since the 1990s. Yet there are few in-depth studies of the specific forms of commercialism that have appeared in Canadian schools or the historical process by which this has occurred. This paper then sketches out the entry of big food into schools, focusing on educators, parents, and students' responses to that process. It reveals some of the local alternatives that developed early on in reaction to unhealthy cafeterias. And it uncovers the process by which provincial governments began to implement bans on soft drinks and to introduce policies promoting healthy food in cafeterias. In 1994, the Toronto Board of Education signed a deal with Pepsi that would pay the board $1.14 million over 3 years for Pepsi's exclusive right to place its products in school vending machines. One of the first boards in Canada to enter into such an agreement, this decision would set a trend for the next 2 decades. Prior to this, individual schools signed contracts with a particular bottler, receiving in return several $100s in revenue. After the Toronto deal, school boards began signing exclusive and often secret multi-million dollar contracts that pertained to the whole school district. As school boards began to sign exclusive soft drink contracts, some commentators wondered what would be next. An editorial in the London Free Press asked, "And if Pepsi, why not school lunchrooms run by McDonald's or Burger King?" By the early 1990s, however, that wasn't the wave of the future. It was already happening. In 1993, the Etobicoke School Board introduced a system of fast food kiosks. As with the fight between Coke and Pepsi to dominate educational and other public institutions, the move of fast food franchises into school cafeterias was part of their effort to secure consumers for the long term. Discussing the situation in British Columbia in 1998, Gary Lev, president of Subway for that province, commented, "Non-traditional locations are the way to go. It won't be too long before you see Subway outlets in high schools here." Indeed, a year later, Terry Fox Secondary School in Port Coquitlam became the first in the region to introduce franchises such as Subway, Pizza Hut, Great Canadian Bagels, and Kentucky Fried Chicken. School trustees justified the negotiation of contracts with soft drink and fast food companies in a variety of ways. They argued that these deals made up for lost revenue after several decades of provincial cuts. Indeed, soft drink funds provided money for such things as sport team uniforms and electronic scoreboards, as well as for library books, computers, and fine arts, early literacy, and gifted programs. In some cases, the deals helped stem the financial hemorrhage of school cafeterias. Despite the fact that contracts with big food could help fill school coffers, support for such deals was never unified. Some trustees agreed to them only reluctantly and for pragmatic reasons. For example, Sandra Boosen, a Toronto School Board trustee at the time of the 1994 Pepsi deal, lamented the need to sell soft drinks in schools, but argued that pop machines already existed and the contract would help to fund lunch programs. Other trustees ideologically supported the financial assistance that private enterprise could provide to schools. Board chairperson David Mole stated, "Some people say this is the thin edge of the wedge. Well, I say I hope it is. If someone wants to pay us to give us computers, that sounds good to me. Step right up." The contracts with Big Food did not proceed, however, without controversy or protest. A few trustees usually opposed the deals, though they tended to form a minority. Teachers' unions often immediately spoke up against the proposals. Students and parents also quickly organized themselves. For example, small numbers protested the 1994 Toronto deal, with students marching on the board's downtown headquarters and teachers and parents attending a school board meeting to request that trustees reconsider their decision. Members of the public also agitated against the secrecy of many of the contracts. And in forcing educational institutions to open up their contracts, they found that payment was directly tied to consumption quotas. Students also spoke out against the belief that all teenagers wanted to eat was fast food. In a letter to the editor of the Globe and Mail, Peter Simeon, a student at Martin Grove Collegiate Institute in Etobicoke, responded to the headline, "Board Caters to Teenage Tastes," by arguing that students ate fast food because that's all that was available. While the signing of and protests against large-scale contracts often stole the limelight, principals, teachers, and parents had for some time been acting in different ways to eliminate some of the unhealthy food in schools. For example, individual schools took action. In the first few years of the 21st century, some restricted access to pop machines, limiting availability to lunch hour or after the end of classes. In some cases, teachers took direct action. At Stratford Northwestern Secondary School, Paul Finkelstein, a culinary arts teacher, opened the Screaming Avocado Cafe in competition with the regular cafeteria in the school run by Chartwell's, a division of Compass Group Canada, a major food service provider. Although a number of individuals and schools developed creative alternatives to fast food cafeterias, these were local solutions. Only government junk food bans would have a wider impact. And those kinds of bans first emerged in the United States and Europe. But by 2005, some provincial governments in Canada had also begun to create healthy food guidelines. Despite their promises, however, provinces were often slow to enact change, and many of the measures were partial in nature. In fact, in 2007, the Globe and Mail would declare Canadian schools to be nutritional wastelands. For example, the 2005 Ontario junk food ban only covered elementary school vending machines. Moreover, even in enacting healthy eating policies, many provinces continued to allow non-nutritious food to remain on the menu, though less often than before. In New Brunswick, for example, schools were allowed to serve foods high in sodium and fat, such as pizza or French fries, though now only twice a week. Still, this was a positive change, and in BC, as a result of healthy food legislation, as well as the financial losses that the fast food franchises in schools were sort of incurring, the franchises were actually taken out of the schools. International discontent over the spread of soft drinks in schools and its impact on children also brought pressure to bear on big food companies, leading some of them to reform their marketing practices. Recognizing public discontent and capitalizing on the turn toward healthy and organic foods, various lobby groups and companies such as the American Beverage Association, Kraft Foods, and Kellogg Company began to announce plans to limit the advertising of less nutritious food to children and to develop more healthy product lines. In responding to public criticism, big food companies thus attempted to situate themselves as part of the solution to childhood obesity. Guidelines developed by Refreshments Canada, the lobby group for the soft drink industry, included the elimination of carbonated beverages from vending machines in elementary and middle schools. Critics argued that that policy ignored the continued sale of diet sodas, high fructose fruit juices, and sports drinks. Nor did it cover high schools, where most of the vending machines were actually located. Still, by 2010, PepsiCo had announced that it would voluntarily remove full-calorie sweetened drinks from schools in more than 200 countries by 2012. Marketing by not marketing had come to be in the best interests of many companies. Well, the attempt by corporations to gain access to the classroom has a long history. A significant body of international research now shows that many corporations intensified their push and received easier access to schools in the 1990s. This occurred for a variety of reasons. School boards looked for new means of revenue after more than a decade of funding cuts. School administrators increasingly promoted school business partnerships. And in their search for new markets, corporations and their advertising agents set their eyes on captive audiences of students. Voicing what corporate leaders, advertisers, and marketers had long known, in 2003, John Elm, CEO of Coca-Cola, defended the sale of soft drinks in schools, stating, "The school system is where you build brand loyalty." While school board contracts with big food have come with a number of costs, the most significant is their potential threat to children's health. Neither soft drinks nor fast food franchises are in and of themselves the culprits. Non-branded school cafeterias are equally to blame. The sugar and fat in cheap, highly processed, and unnutritious foods, the increasing availability and consumption of such foods, along with a lack of exercise, are contributing to an unhealthy generation. Yet the competitive marketing of products, the encouragement of consumption, and the accessibility to fast food cannot but add to that process. The entry of big food into schools has occurred with the complicity of school boards and often with the support of parents and students and sometimes teachers who see corporations as useful partners in sustaining public education or who see the need for funds as overwhelming. Those who resist corporate incursion argue that childhood should be protected and the schoolhouse should be commercial-free, that fast food and pop are detrimental to children's health and should not be endorsed or encouraged by the school system, that exclusivity agreements threaten freedom of speech and action, and that decisions about children's well-being are being made without public discussion or parental consent. At the local level, widespread protest over schools' commercial activities has had mixed success. But public discontent about school policies, the work of activists and teachers' unions, the specter of increasing child obesity, the cultural turn toward local and healthy food, along with the example set by a number of international precedents, has put pressure on provincial governments to develop school policies and guidelines. Those efforts have also forced corporations to undertake some policy changes in regard to marketing unhealthy food to children. It seems clear that while local actions can have a significant impact on public discussion and sometimes meet success, government intervention is required to ensure all students have access to healthy, commercial-free spaces. Some see the criticism of big food in the schools as ignoring the real problems in the education system. Moreover, they offer truisms such as healthy eating begins at home, or if students can't get access to fries, pop, and chocolate bars at school, they will leave the school grounds. And these statements are no doubt true. Yet public schools do not just replicate societal patterns, but also aim to create educated citizens. After all, if parents don't read to their children at home, the education system does not discontinue its literacy programs. Much research suggests that the physical health of children contributes to their mental and intellectual health. Indeed, school curricula specifically teach nutrition and give time to physical education. The separation of the classroom from the hallway or the cafeteria ignores the reality of school as a learning environment in all of its dimensions. Indeed, it ignores the fact that for better or worse, some of the most significant and long-lasting lessons are learned once students are no longer at their desks. Thanks.